Hi, good morning and welcome. We are still trying to do this episode on permaculture and a great workshop coming up in December by these two amazing people, Kyle and Phil. Kyle, your specialty is plastering, natural plastering, and you started Kamimomi Permaculture Center in Okayama. Now, Phil, you're based in Chiba, is that right?
Yes, I'm based in Chiba, but I work a lot in Tokyo as well.
So, can you tell us a little bit about, you said you do a permaculture farm called Awa, is it?
Yeah, for the last 13 or so years, we've had a small farm here, much smaller than the scale that Kyle works in Okayama. And it's kind of more modeling a family size homestead. So we're looking at about 1,000 square meters, a small one building, outdoor kitchen, you know, some chickens, vegetable garden, just enough for people to live close to the land, but still sort of manage their own job, their own work, stuff like that. Have a regular kind of life, not fully immersing yourself in like farming, but yeah, trying to live sustainably and ecologically.
That's cool.
Recently, yeah. I started it's been 3 years, but a community arts center in Kamogawa, which is about 20 minutes from where the farm is. And this is a little bit bigger. It's based around a really old complex of buildings. The buildings are actually UK Bunkazai, so they're kind of culturally significant buildings. 180, 150-year-old buildings. Used to be a sake brewery. It has a thatched roof and all that. The whole nine yards is a beautiful complex, which has been loaned to us. And we're doing a lot of musical events, a lot of festivals. We're currently, as we speak, running a permaculture design course here. We've got about 26 participants from all over Japan, and myself and Kyle and another guy whom you may know, Kai Sawyer. He's made like permaculture films and written a couple books, and he's quite well known in Japan. But the three of us, we run a course here every year, and that's going on as we speak. And I also do a lot of work in Tokyo. I got two daughters. One is a first year in uni, and the other one is first year in high school. And they're both like grew up in the country, but they want to be in the city. You know what I mean? I mean, that's how it all turns out. I grew up in Shibuya, and here I am trying to talk them into living with me in the country. But they're like, as soon as they get their wings, they're out of here. And they're in Tokyo now pursuing their passions. So I spend a lot of time in Tokyo now working on projects, and I'm really interested in developing urban permaculture programs. And we have two rooftop gardens on big like corporate buildings. And we're trying to break that scene into like a more financially sustainable kind of model, where, you know, we can actually start employing people and growing food and selling food and, yeah, getting a nice sustainable buzz happening in Tokyo.
That's great. So lots of exciting projects going on. Yeah. And Kyle, you mentioned in the description for the seminar coming up in December, you and Phil have been working on projects for 15 years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I actually just found some photos of when I first met Phil in 2009.
Amazing. Yeah. And Kyle, how long have you been in Japan?
I first came to Japan 25 years ago and have lived here for over 21 years.
That's amazing. And your focus, you're working with John Stollenmeyer. You're doing a lot of different projects with different people, including Phil right now. But your focus really is on natural plastering. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm trained as a plasterer. That's kind of my trade. And living in the countryside, in addition to plastering, I do a lot of farming as well.
Yeah. And so for the December project, it's called Living Earth Lab. And some of the key points, maybe if we just go through one at a time and you just give us an explanation for people that might not know, for example, the idea of Satoyama, how would you kind of explain that in an overview?
Sure. Satoyama is a Japanese word, and Sato kind of means like countryside, and Yama is, like village. Sato means like countryside village, and Yama is mountain. And it kind of describes where actually 90% of the Japanese population lived, before industrialization. In fact, during the Edo period, the most populated prefecture in Japan was Niigata Prefecture. Most of the people lived land-based lives, connected to the land, involved in farming. And Satoyama is kind of like a traditional Japanese village, is kind of what it describes. And I think kind of in all places in the world, before industrialization, humans had a sustainable circular economy. And you find that in traditional Satoyama villages as well. And part of our work at Permaculture Center Kamimomi is reviving that Satoyama, but it's not just returning to the traditional ways. It's kind of meeting the needs of modern people, incorporating modern technologies like photovoltaic systems and things like that to develop a sustainable life and circular economy.
Yeah, I'm showing some pictures from your website of the beautiful rice paddies and the mountains around your area. So the idea of Satoyama making use of the natural surroundings and not damaging the environment in any way in your practices, so that downstream is also kept pure and natural. In many ways, that ties in perfectly with permaculture, I imagine. Is that right?
Exactly.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, before industrialization, people had no choice but to live sustainably. So always conscious of their resource use and then of their waste stream too. Not polluting the water downstream from themselves, and trying to close all the loops, trying to make every byproduct or every waste a resource for another activity.
I'm showing your website now for Kamimomi, and I'll share the link here if people want to get more information. And then they can also get information about the upcoming seminars and open days, like you mentioned before too, right?
Yeah, from our webpage, pamimomi.com. But you'll also find lots of updated information at our Facebook page. That's probably where we're most active.
Okay. So one of the other key concepts of this seminar, 7-day seminar coming up, December 3rd to the 9th, is natural building. So Kyle, what can people expect if they're coming for a natural building workshop or something at Kamimomi?
Well, for most of our buildings, we try to make use of as much of the resources from our mountain as possible. So for a lot of our buildings, we harvest timber from the mountain. We've milled it on site. We can also have it milled at a local sawmill. We harvest bamboo locally. We get earth for building from the mountain. We get straw from the rice fields. We get rice husks from milling rice. So yeah, trying to make use of natural and local materials as much as possible.
And then one of the other key concepts, food self-sufficiency. Phil, you're doing organic farming, rooftop farming, even in urban areas. So the idea of food self-sufficiency, of course, is part of a sustainable life. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. To be quite honest, I don't actually live as sort of food sustainably as Kyle does. And I think it's an interesting difference that we have in our approach to how we actually approach permaculture and approach the way we live and kind of how we approach what we value and what like the skills we want to develop. So I think that's another real interesting quality about what you've been calling a seminar, which I think our focus here is less on talking and learning like rote learning, but actually getting your hands in and experimenting and trying all kinds of different things. And I'm imagining the course as being the classroom for the course as being this entire mountain hillside that Kyle is living on. And there's just so much going on there and so many ways that we can harness the natural resources that are there in order to fulfill the needs of a modern lifestyle. And probably most of the participants won't be people living in such environments, but they might be living in small towns or in cities, in apartment buildings and whatnot, and just sort of thinking about, dreaming about maybe one day living in the countryside. And the cool thing is you can learn so many things at Kyle's place, living on the mountain and work like doing natural building and farming and all that kind of stuff, that you can actually apply in your life in the place that you live currently. So yeah, my interest with things like food is like, how can you actually grow food? The one question I'm really curious about now and developing is, how do you grow food in your kitchen? You know, how much food, how many calories can you produce in an amount of time inside your kitchen, like within reachable distance from your sink? You know, there's just all these opportunities and all these possibilities. I think we're just trying to break out of the mold of like what traditional food production looks like. And especially with all the technologies that we have at our access, there are just so many different ways that we can explore that. And it takes a kind of an urban mindset to see, okay, this is how you germinate a seed, or this is how you make a seedling. It's like, how could I actually make this happen in my little apartment in Shimokitazawa or something, you know? And I think those are just different sort of paths that people can take on their journey to discovering what it means for them to live more sustainably, more responsibly, more with more health. Yeah, everybody has a different journey, and just trying to kind of broaden the horizon a little bit, you know. So yeah. This course is kind of cool in that where Kyle is on his mountain, he's in his element, he's like this wolf running around on the hillside, and I live in the country now, but I'm more of a towny kind of mindset. Like, yeah, what can we do with AI? You know, what can we do with, technology?
But I love that, because you're bringing probably the most common experience for people living in Japan are living in cities, right? Like Kyle's case is really unique and wonderful. Of course, even city dwellers, we try to order subscription boxes from organic farms. We can support that way. But I love that idea, Phil, of how much can you grow in your own kitchen. I'm a horrible at growing my own food. I've tried for many years. Maybe I'm too busy. Maybe I just don't have the right skills, but I'm hoping always to learn from people who can do that. That is not easy. But, you know, I've talked to, for example, John Walsh, mm-hmm. who's also based in Tokyo, yep. and also really passionate about urban farming and what can you do on your balcony and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it is exciting, right? Use the space that mm-hmm. you have. I love that. Now, Phil talked more about maybe more people's situation, but Kyle, how much of food self-sufficiency are you able to do at Kamimomi? Are you pretty much 100% self-sufficient now?
I think we strive to be 100% self-sufficient. I would like to think that we have everything in the Japanese Satoyama except for maybe sashimi and salt. But yeah, we still buy some spices and like chomidio type of stuff, like mirin and those type of things. But we're also producing miso and soy sauce, and it would be great to also produce mirin and, you know, expand the variety of things that we produce.
That's amazing. You're making mirin now?
No, would like to. I guess that's
okay. The next step. Okay. You're making, no, you said miso though.
Yeah, we make miso, we make soy sauce.
Wow.
And yeah, we'd like to start making mirin as well.
Are you making your own sake?
I can't say that on live.
Oh, sorry. I'm television. Sorry. Unofficial. Sorry. But making your own miso and soy sauce, that's awesome. I visited Shodoshima soy sauce maker recently, and he is trying to bring the traditions of wooden barrel making back. Because for wooden barrels and soy sauce and miso, you're adding so much flavor depth, right? With the old traditions of wooden barrels. Are you guys also using wooden barrels?
No, we use just a regular pickling barrel that would be sold at the local home center.
Okay. But he was saying nobody knew how to do it anymore. So he was doing this seminar once a year to bring people who wanted to relearn how to make these barrels. So maybe they're not so far from you guys. Maybe you could collaborate with them someday.
Yeah, definitely.
That'd be great. Another key point for the seminar coming up is energy systems. Kyle, you want to talk about that?
Whichever. Sure. I think maybe we can both say a few words about it. For energy is a really broad term, and it kind of covers everything from cooking, heating, producing hot water. These are all different aspects of daily life that involve energy. So on the energy day, we'll probably look at different cooking tools. Different cooking elements like a rocket stove or a nukakudo, which is a rice cooker that uses rice husks as a fuel to cook rice. We'll also talk about like firewood and also make charcoal. And then also look at, you know, things like photovoltaic systems and, you know, producing electricity from the sun. You want to say some stuff?
Yeah. So just like Kyle sort of outlined right now, there's a lot of different things happening on this property in terms of energy, a lot of new infrastructure going in, and sort of old existing permaculture being infrastructure being updated. And I think that's what's really cool about permaculture and about this project as well, is that the things that get implemented aren't like fixed final designs, that things continue to evolve as the project evolves and as technology evolves and as resources change. Doing things like the new photovoltaic array that Kyle is planning. We've installed like various like water reservoirs on the property to allow for more regular and constant access to water. All kinds of different heating elements that our curiosity sort of goes into new areas, like, hey, we just saw this really cool stove that maybe we can try building it for the next workshop, whatnot. And then we also have a really strong design component, which I think ultimately becomes the largest energy conservation element, is that if your site and your elements are designed in an efficient, energy efficient way, particularly things like placement, like if the energy points and the energy use points and storage points, if those things are designed in your property in efficient relative location in terms of like where the energy is needed, then you basically conserve a lot of energy. So like, I don't know if you've ever been to Kyle's property, but it's on a really steep slope. And as you know, heavy things tend to struggle going up the hill, and things tend to enjoy rolling down the hill. So there's this amazing, probably the most amazing form of energy called gravity, which we often underutilize. So harvesting things from higher up, for example, in the forest above the property, and using it in different stages as it's inclined to roll down the hill. The same with water. Starts at the top of the hill. As it naturally flows down, it's used in different points. And basically, on its journey from the top of the site to the bottom of the site, it gets used at different points, as long as the design is adapted to take that into consideration, you know. So, yeah. Designing for energy efficiency, I think, is a big part of this learning experience.
I love that. Have you heard of Asby Brown's book, Just Enough?
Yeah, and it's an incredible book.
He has beautiful illustrations, right, of the Satoyama and how it should be designed so that you can utilize gravity, you can utilize water flow. Kyle, did you just buy your place and it was already designed that way? Or did you really have to think about how to design things when you moved in?
I would say both. The design follows a typical or traditional Satoyama design, a typical Japanese homestead. But I mean, we've also included lots of elements to expand that. And kind of following on what you and Phil just said about using elevation differences to move materials and make things energy efficient, you see that in traditional Japanese homesteads as well. So for example, if you look at a really typical Japanese homestead, you've kind of got a mountain behind the house and a river somewhere down below the house. And between that, you'll have the homestead. And so beneath the house, you'll have generally your vegetable gardens, and beneath that, you'll have your rice fields. So all of the kitchen waste and human waste coming out of the house can be composted and used as fertilizer in the intensive gardens. And all of the wastewater coming out of the house can be used for watering those gardens, and then is purified in the rice fields before it goes into the river and flows, you know, to the farm downstream from you. And behind the house, you'll have, let's say, a plantation forest. So you're bringing heavy lumber down to the work site, right, as opposed to bringing it up. And you'll also have a mixed deciduous forest behind the house that you would go to and get firewood. And that firewood is harvested, brought down to, generally there's a charcoal kiln between the forest and the house. That firewood is made light into charcoal, and then that light charcoal can be brought down to the house. So, you know, although the traditional Japanese farmers never used the word permaculture, these same principles were understood and used.
Isn't that, it's so exciting and interesting. Often it's indigenous cultures that do this naturally, right? They've been doing it throughout time. Like even in Hawaii, where I grew up, now going back after talking to you, Kyle, and then realizing that actually indigenous Hawaiian culture, they use that same concept of Satoyama, of the streams using gravity through the taro imo farms, and then to the fish ponds at the bottom. And of course they would never add anything bad because they were using it at every step of the way and using lots of compost techniques as well, even indigenously. I had a great activity going back to University of Hawaii and going to their traditional farms and learning how they're using that farm as education. Mm. Oh man, I would love to see something like that happen in Japan too. But I guess that's what you're doing at your place, is an education center as well as actually living and self-sustaining, right?
Yeah, that's the main purpose, is education. It's more than just like a family homestead. It's a place for people to come and live and learn and work together.
That's awesome. I've been showing pictures from your website, and these are the kinds of images people can imagine if they're coming to a workshop or an open day. So here you have like a talking circle discussing some of the concepts. Behind you, is that one of the stoves you were talking about?
Yeah, that's an earth oven. I would probably say that Phil is probably maybe the godfather of the earth oven pizza party in Japan. Probably the guy who got it all started.
That's awesome. Did you create one as well in your place, Phil?
I've made a bunch of them. I try to limit myself to one a year. But no, Kyle and I mean, we probably built... You had a part in building the first earth oven, I think, that we built back in like 2010 in Odawara. And we started building these things mobile so that we could take them to places. And then the idea caught on that you would build an oven. So we had our sort of seed oven. You would take it somewhere to a community where people wanted to start, say, a community garden or some kind of a farm or a community center, or maybe like a garden for a nursery school or elementary school or something. So we'd pull up with this mobile oven and build an oven while we had parties with the previous oven. So it was kind of like this ovens giving birth to ovens thing. And each oven workshop would create one or two oven builders. So I don't know if you know, but we have oven builders, like dozens of oven builders all over Japan now. And wherever they go, they build ovens. So there could be hundreds of these all over Japan now in communities where they just, get together and sort of DIY their way through starting new gardens and new farms and new little community learning centers.
I love it. Is this what you're building in this picture on the right, Kyle? Is that also an earth oven?
That's right. I think that earth oven is at the Permaculture and Peace Dojo in Izumi in Chiba Prefecture. And that is a cow manure and earth finish. The cow manure is added to the earth to improve the water resistance and the durability of the earth finish.
When I traveled in India, a lot of local people were using cow manure and put it with hay, extra hay, and then that was a fire starter. So it's interesting, all these parallels around the world, right?
Yeah.
And then
we're going to be baking pizzas on December 21st at Permaculture Center Kamimomi. It's our end of the year party, but anybody's welcomed. Starting at noon, we'll be baking pizzas. We usually bake about 80 pizzas.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I think we're doing a pizza party tonight, actually, here. There's this great photograph we need to share with you. It's me, Kyle, and one other of our original pizza making buddies called Michael, a British guy. And the title of the photograph is Changing the World One Pizza at a Time. It's one of my favorite photographs. And we look kind of zany and young.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
There's a local bakery started by a Spanish Japanese couple. They met on woofing in Europe. Yeah. They fell in love, came back, started farming, doing organic farming, took over a cafe. Now they have a really successful bakery and restaurant called Oheso. So if you come to Hiro,
I've been there. Yeah, it's a great place.
Awesome. Yeah. And his pizzas have become so famous that he also sells pizza ovens. So you guys, between you guys, you're supplying pizza ovens to all of Japan. It's fantastic. and then one of the other things about forest stewardship, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we have a large cypress plantation forest on the property. After World War II, there was a lack of building materials. And so there was a real push to plant cedar and hinoki, cedar and cypress, so the sugi and hinoki. And with economic development, it became less expensive to buy lumber from overseas than to use native Japanese trees. And so these cedar and cypress plantations have largely gone unmanaged. And so we oftentimes felt, for the course in December, we actually have somebody coming from the Okayama Forestry Department who's going to come and work with students and how to use a chainsaw, how to sharpen a chain, how to fell a tree. And then he's also going to lead a section on how to make bamboo charcoal as well.
That sounds great.
Yeah, bamboo is another resource that in rural Japan, it's a real problem because bamboo used to be fundamental to life in Japan. So many utensils and tools and things used on a daily basis were made from bamboo. And now it's all been taken over by plastics. So, and the bamboo groves have gone unmanaged. Learning how to use bamboo again and to make uses of bamboo is another really important thing about forestry management.
Absolutely. I hear that from everybody who buys these beautiful old properties in the rural areas, that one of the first things they have to do is beat back the bamboo from going under the foundations. Yeah. And so many local Japanese people always tell me, as long as you keep using bamboo, it's fantastic. But the problem is, like you said, everything has been kind of switched to using plastic instead. And so it's just going nuts everywhere. So using it for charcoal, using it for anything again, that's such a great practice.
Yeah, it's an incredible resource.
For sure. Do you have bamboo on your property? Is that what be in front of the forest there in that picture?
I think that's what you see behind that, the new house there is a bamboo grove.
That's awesome.
And this year we've been on the property for 8 years. And every year I've been thinking, oh, I want to clean this up. Finally, this year we were able to really thin out the bamboo grove. So every year looking better and better.
I'm sure he'll tell us on the seminar, but I'm sure there's special techniques. How do you thin it? How do you know how much to cut? That kind of stuff is not really like obvious, right? So it takes an expert to really teach you how to do it properly, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it's not that difficult. I think for example, you're looking to thin it out. Ideally, you want depends on the species of bamboo, but if you want that bamboo to grow to its maximum potential, you want to thin it out to about a meter between bamboo. They say that you can walk in a bamboo grove with an umbrella.
Would be pretty thinned out. Yeah.
Yeah. Very thinned out. Very thinned out.
We have a beautiful gardens here, Shikane Gardens in Hiroshima, which I often take visitors through, and they have a little beautiful bamboo grove, and the gardeners do such a beautiful job of when the bamboo shoots start coming in. I notice it takes only 2 weeks for it to be up at my height. Like these things, man, they grow so fast. But telling visitors you can eat it, you can wear it, you can make sheets out of it, you can use it for your house. Like bamboo has so many wonderful uses. Let's bring those back. I love it.
Yep.
Now another picture here, Kyle. Oh, that was the discussion. And then here is this looks like part of the natural plaster making process. Can you tell us what people are doing?
Yeah, actually in that photo, people are stomping cob. Cob is a form of natural building that's used throughout the world. It's a mix of earth, sand, and straw or some other fiber. And in Japanese, it'd be called like neri uchi. So you mix the earth and you kind of just stack it on top of itself without using any kind of formwork. It's probably more popular abroad than it is in Japan. In Japan, that would be mainly used for garden walls around houses. What's kind of similar in Japan would be the arakabe, the base coat plaster. A typical Japanese wall system, there's a timber frame and a bamboo lattice built between the timber frame. And then that earth plaster is applied to the bamboo lattice to create walls.
Like in this picture, would that be more typical?
Yeah, this is also kind of like a tweak on the traditional Japanese system where you have horizontal bamboo lath and we're plastering directly onto that with an earth plaster.
That looks awesome. Phil, are you also a plasterer after working with Kyle many years? Have you done some plastering?
I still haven't taken a proper workshop that Kyle teaches, and I keep hoping I do one day. But I've been winging it for years. I've not had any formal training. But I started out in my early 20s as kind of a design builder, so I would build things that I knew nothing about out of materials that cost as little as possible. So I often found myself digging up bits of clay and working with it. So I have a very limited but skill, but deep love and appreciation for clay and plastering and
It's so beautiful. I love it. And we have a 70-year-old house. I've done some of the walls. I order the plaster pre-mixed. Sorry, Kyle, but I would love to know how to do it, like from the elements. When I go back to Hawaii, also in Waikiki, one of the oldest hotels, the Royal Hawaiian, it's amazing. Kyle, if you ever go and Phil, you have to visit, you can actually see the handprints in the foyer of how they hand plastered that whole area.
Wow.
And the beauty of it, they don't need any air conditioning. It still has that natural airflow. Because of using natural materials and making it in such a beautiful design. I just, I get so inspired whenever I travel everywhere, right? Even where I grew up, I appreciate it more.
Awesome.
It's awesome. And then we talked about design mindset a little bit, that idea of planning, having a vision for what you're creating, even your home, how to design things in the natural flow. Or Phil, you probably have some insights how to even design your terrace or how to design your kitchen so it would be more easy to grow your own food, for example. Is that right?
Yeah. I think talking about design in a very short period of time is kind of difficult. But I think there are a few things that we tend to overlook when we think of design, and the biggest one, I think, being what do you actually need? You know, when you're designing something, you're aiming to create some kind of a function to serve some kind of a need that you think you have. And often those things that motivate you to design and to create and to build, you've not really clearly identified before you go into it. You kind of say, I want a house with a good view that has a composting toilet. And basically you take those three things and you kind of make generalizations about what they are and then put them together and expect your needs to be met. And often they're not. So I think design is a really long process and a journey for everyone. And it's really important, I think, for people to have a strong grasp of what the design process is rather than leaving other people do it, because a couple things happen when you're really involved with the design and you understand where the design comes from and how it's really a process that you need to be, the more you're a part of, then it's likely that the design is actually going to serve what you're wanting it to. But it's not something that you sort of farm out to designers and to carpenters and whatnot. I have a strong belief in the design starting from proper care given to sort of introspection and understanding what are you really aiming for here and why do you want that? And then from there, exploring the different strategies, you know, of like, how would I get, for example, you know, if you wanted a house with a beautiful view on a hill in Okayama, chances are you're looking for quiet, you're looking for peace, you're looking for health, good health, fresh air. A lot to do with maybe being able to focus on your work. So when you're clear about what those core underlying objectives are, then you start to make different decisions. If you're not aware of them, you might end up building the most beautiful house overlooking the most beautiful view next to like a crazy neighbor who's constantly like bothering you, you know? So just having a clarity about what you want, what your vision is, and then sort of setting out and thinking of your strategies from there. So I don't know, when we talk about design, it's a lot about kind of figuring out who you are, what you want, and what you really want out of life. And then taking a really close look at the land and figuring out, okay, what does this land really want to do? You don't want your views and your objectives to be in conflict with what the land is naturally inclined for or naturally in the process of already sort of evolving in that direction. You don't want to be fighting the natural energies in the land. So, yeah, identifying what you want as the person who's going to inhabit the design, understanding the place that you're trying to inhabit and understanding what it's most inclined to be and how it's most inclined to serve you, and then putting those together. And you may have to compromise a little bit in order to match what the property or the land or the material that you have to work with has to offer. But in the end, you basically find you're tuned into a nice kind of a sweet spot where you're not fighting the site. The site is serving your needs, and you're kind of aiming for that, yeah, that balance. And that takes a lot of observation and some time to really, I mean, we like to say you really need to take a look for 12 months, just like one annual cycle at a site before you really understand how you really want to interact with it, you know?
Yeah. How frustrating, right? When you see a beautiful location and you see a beautiful building, but obviously they did not design it there, and they designed it in a city somewhere, and they sent that building over, and it doesn't take in the view, or it doesn't work there.
Totally.
Right? Alex Kerr often talks about listening to the house before you redesign it. Once you move into a traditional house, there's so much knowledge there, wisdom there. I appreciate that so much. That's awesome. 12 months. You got to go and visit that location 12 months before you redesign it. I like that. Also on the seminar, talking about bilingual support. So people speaking English or speaking Japanese are very welcome. You're going to have a very mixed language support. Is that right?
Talk about this. Yeah. Generally, we imagine that Japanese students will be the main participants. So we'll probably be teaching in Japanese most of the time. But we have an interpreter named Norie Fukuda-san. She's American Japanese, grew up in Japan, fluent in both languages, and she'll be helping to interpret into English anything that we don't have a chance to mention in English.
That's great. It's great to have that inclusivity, and it's not just for one group or the other. We are living in Japan, but we are internationals. So I love that the quote that you have, rooted in Japan yet connecting to the world, as your concept for the seminar, and of course so many things that you do. Now, Phil, one thing you mentioned, which I think a lot of people are interested in, especially if they're taking over traditional houses in the rural area, maybe not connected to the sewage line, is compost toilets. Can you just give us a little overview? Like, even in urban areas, do compost toilets work? How difficult is it to kind of incorporate compost toilets into the design? Do you need a big redesign idea, or is it pretty straightforward these days?
I wouldn't say it's straightforward. I guess the closest I could get to like a very brief answer would be that it's really depends on the site and the user and what the site is connected to. The ideal situation is because a composting, the whole idea behind a composting toilet is to create compost, right? It does manage your waste, but I mean, if you're really into composting, if you're really into making use of your waste and treating it as a resource, what you're after every time you go to the toilet is you're growing the potential for your food in the compost, right? So it's great to have a point of use of what you're creating. So you can make great compost out of a composting toilet, but if you don't have a point of use, or if your point of use is 50 kilometers away, then taking it there becomes an issue. So there's all kinds of different composting toilets. I've probably made more toilets than I have ovens. And it's just an ongoing area of exploration. I've not met anyone more passionate about toilets than myself. I've been, talking about crap since I was a kid, and now people pay me to do it, so it's great.
But that's awesome. In Asby Brown's book as well, Just Enough, right? He talks about the night soil collectors that used to be during the Edo period coming around collecting the night soil. Mm-hmm. And that was from the toilets. Yeah. So even traditional Japanese toilets were pit toilets, which is not that far different from a compost toilet in theory, right? Now, Kyle, you're doing it at Kamimomi. We talked about this last time. And then you store for 2 years or something before using it. Is that right?
Yeah, our compost, the human manure compost for 2 years before we use it in the orchard and the gardens.
And then how did you learn that system? Is that like a basic permaculture system that's been based on indigenous knowledge, or where did that come from?
The system that we use at Pamimomi right now, and the system that I use at my house as well, is based off of Jenkins' The Human Manure Handbook, and it's a super simple system with a 20-liter bucket, for the Americans a 5-gallon bucket, with a seat just like a regular toilet. Everything goes into the toilet paper, and then after using the toilet, you cover it with sawdust. So oftentimes it's called a sawdust toilet. And then when that bucket's full, it needs to be emptied into a composting station. And we have roughly 2 cubic meter bins, so 2 meters by 1 meter by a meter tall. And it will take us over a year to fill one of those bins at Pamimomi. And we've got, let's say on average, 4 or 5 people living there all the time. And it will take over a year, maybe up to 2 years, to fill one of those bins. And it's not just human manure going into that. It's all of the kitchen scraps as well. And then our chickens get into it every day. And that is such a beautiful example of matching needs and gifts. One of the primary principles of permaculture is relative location. And what that means is placing elements in the design so the needs and gifts of those elements can be met by the other elements in that location. And this is a really beautiful example of where the chickens are getting so much of their nutritional needs from the compost in the form of they're eating the kitchen scraps. And they're also eating the larvae of the flies that have laid their eggs in the compost. And for city dwellers, that might sound kind of gross, but for country folk, that's such a beautiful way to meet your chickens' energy needs, their food needs, is they're making use of our waste. And they're also providing other functions, like they're tilling the top of the compost. They're like turning the compost. I find that the compost breaks down so much faster with the chickens introduced into that system. But you can still do it without chickens. You don't need chickens in your compost to make it work. But yeah, that's kind of what we do at Permaculture Center Kamimomi.
And you're separating out the liquid, right? Isn't it separate systems, or you keep it together?
We keep it together. We keep it together. And that's a really long, deep conversation.
Yeah, because I know a lot of systems, they'll separate the liquid and the solid and with sawdust. And then some systems are like churning the sawdust pile. Phil, you've tried different methods, is that right?
I'm like, so you're getting me started here.
Is right? Okay.
I'm just like, don't get me started.
This could be a whole topic for another talk.
This is why the course is seven days, right?
It's like after you get used to these systems and then you flush a toilet, you're like, all that water waste, like, do we need to use that much water? Mm-hmm. No, the answer is no, right?
Yeah. Well, the answer always, Joy, is it depends.
Yeah.
But because one of the most exciting sort of innovations recently is we have these micro flush toilets. So we're just using a very small amount of water, which effectively cleans your toilet bowl. And it also seals this lid at the bottom of the bowl. And if you've used composting toilets, you probably know that, the main problems, the main reason why everybody doesn't have one is because, number one, it smells, if it's not designed properly, and insects are attracted to it because it smells. So you have fruit flies and other flies, and you have the smell, which just creates an unpleasant experience. And a lot of people who are in this game say, get over it, you know, it's not dirty. But the fact is, it stinks, and nobody likes to have flies buzzing around their eyes when they're trying to go to the toilet. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about making compost toilets such that you don't know you're using a composting toilet, so that anybody, especially in Japan, where, as you know, the culture of designing toilets to be beautiful works of art. I mean, the innovation in the toilet scene here is just amazing, right? I mean, people should be getting like Nobel Prizes for
part of one of my tours on Miyajima Island is taking people to the rest stop, which is sponsored by Toto. Uh-huh. Toto, the toilet company, right? And everybody who visits Japan now is like searching, can I get one of these toilets when I go home? Because I don't think I can live without it.
Yeah. You know? Totally. I don't know, Joy, if you've watched the film Perfect Days. It's like absolutely, hands down, my favorite film that I've watched this year. And it's about a Japanese guy. It's called Perfect Days. The soundtrack is awesome. Lots of Lou Reed. It's by Wim Wenders. Amazing artist, right? But this guy basically goes around these beautiful artistic toilets in Tokyo. He's a toilet cleaner and just goes around cleaning toilets. And the way he cleans them and the way the toilets are designed is just phenomenal. Anyway, this is the country we live in. We take toilets seriously. And I honestly believe that if we can take composting toilets to the next level in Japan, that this is where the innovation is going to happen. And once they become like amazing, like the washlets, then people will basically want to use them, you know?
And absolutely.
I don't think people need to change in order to adapt to more sustainable ways of life. It's just our strategies and our technologies and our designs need to get updated so that, you know, there's no more hesitation. It's like, it's better. It's easier. Makes sense.
That's such a good point.
Yeah.
I love telling visitors that my kids had books all about what animals poop looks like, and Everybody Poops, I think it's called. And in Japanese, they used to talk about what the shape is different, and then no shame talking about their own poop. And then at festivals, even you can get poop hats or, you know, poop wands. So this country is not ashamed of talking about the toilet. This would be the place to make it happen. I like that idea, Phil.
I don't know if you know of this artist, an Austrian artist called Hundertwasser.
Is he the one designing the toilets around Japan that we see?
No, this Hundertwasser is he's no longer with us. He was an artist from the 70s and 80s, a painter and an architect, and just an overall like amazing conceptual artist. And he also designed composting toilets. But he has this great phrase, and I don't know if you can say this on your podcast, but it's shit is gold. And it really kind of flips the table. That's kind of, that was a real aha moment for me. You know, I was like,
wow,
what is this guy talking about? And it kind of connects with everything Kyle's been talking about and what permaculture is about. The thing that we most think of as being useless and dirty and something we want to hide, you know, and get out of the places of where we live, is actually possibly the only really beneficial thing that we can contribute to our environment.
Yeah.
You know, as an animal, it's like our feces is pretty much what the other organisms are wanting from us, other than our dead bodies, you know, maybe a little CO2 now and again.
Well, it's that whole concept of back to nature, right? Like everything you use should be able to go back to nature once you've finished using it.
Yes.
So then the whole concept of plastic packaging doesn't work because it does not go back to nature. Mm-hmm. What are we doing? The whole concept of using chemicals doesn't work because we're actually damaging our water systems and ourselves in the future. So everything you guys are talking about, the whole circularity of permaculture and sustainable living is just wonderful. We only have a few minutes left. Is there anything we haven't talked about in terms of your collaboration and the upcoming seminar that you wanted to cover?
Well, as Phil mentioned, one of the main aspects about the permaculture skills course is the permaculture design mindset. And I've had an opportunity to work a lot in different areas of Japan and also work abroad in permaculture, natural building, plastering. And everywhere I go, I think Phil's designs are the best. So this is a really incredible opportunity, I think, to actually work and learn from Phil.
Yeah.
Thanks. So anything nice you want to say about Kyle now that he's passed the baton to you?
I don't want to play that game. Thanks,
Oh, I'm sure you guys are a powerhouse of information talking together. I think anybody coming would be very, very deeply impacted in their daily life, in their decisions they're making.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I'd like to mention as well is that the food is really incredible.
Yes.
And that's also another thing that I, it's actually one of the things that makes traveling, difficult for me is anywhere I go, it's like, oh man, I miss the food at home. It's just not only is the quality of the ingredients, really good and the preparation very good, but also just having that connection, knowing exactly where it came from, and how it was grown and how it was produced, how it was handled. The food is really, really good.
Awesome. I saw this picture of Kamimomi, you guys growing rice. Of course, in Japan, there's been a rice shortage. You're, of course, growing rice organically and sustainably. Having food that's grown sustainably and naturally is still very rare in Japan. Mm. So being able to eat farm to table is a wonderful part of the experience. One other interesting thing you're doing is kind of a sliding scale for payment. Can you touch on that a little bit?
You want to talk about that?
You go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So kind of in order in an attempt to kind of meet everybody's economic situation, everybody's conditions, we've provided a sliding scale. So people that have more to give can pay more. People who don't have that much can pay less. And so we are kind of our ideal is that everybody who wants to participate can participate without kind of sacrificing their fundamental needs. And then whatever we can generate an income just goes to supporting our work in preserving Japanese Satoyama and in promoting permaculture.
I'm just providing the link to the Google form here where people can sign in and get more information about the Living Earth Label or Living Earth Lab coming up that you guys are collaborating on. Thank you guys so much for joining. It's wonderful to talk to you. Good luck with your project in Chiba. Of course, good luck with your project in Okayama. And I hope we can meet up someday and chat more in person.
Yeah.
But until then, I would love to have you back on the show. Chatting online is always fun too. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, do you have another minute? Just a minute.
Yes, let me just log off the live and then we can chat for a minute.
Oh, okay.
Or do you want to tell the audience?
Yeah, I would like to
okay,
say
go
I
ahead,
think
go
something
ahead.
Nice I could think about Kyle.
So. Okay, go ahead.
No, I really think what he's doing is, I've thought for many years, just incredibly unique and special. And it's just such an amazing project. And I've been saying to him for years, you know, NHK should come down and just film what you're doing because this is incredible. What he's doing with the land, how relevant it is to where the country is now and how the countryside is really needing this, you know, new kind of energy in order for it to survive. And we have Kyle like tackling it from so many different perspectives. It's really awe-inspiring and I'm inspired every time I go there. And for people who want to know a little bit more in depth about actually what he's doing there, finally, the people at NHK got their act together and they made a 1-hour special about him, which is screening, I think, next couple of weeks, right?
It's like November 8th at 11 p.m. November 8th at 11 p.m. on NHK Kyoiku. So the NHK educational channel.
That's awesome. Well, we'll try to put a link below as well. Kyle, congratulations.
Yeah.
You well deserved many 8 years of hard work, and absolutely, Phil, absolutely perfect timing to be talking about so many of these issues.
Yes.
And the appeal of growing your own food and sustainable design and living in the rural areas of Japan and the value of that as well, for sure. I can't wait to see it. Kyle, was it fun to do it? Were you nervous?
They've actually been filming from May.
Oh, wow.
From May, and they just finished filming just recently. So, yeah, it's a long process. It's you spend all that time just on, you know, featuring our project. But, you know, I'm grateful for that. And, yeah, looking forward to seeing how it turns out.
That's fantastic. And of course, it'll have a big audience in Japan, but also NHK is very well watched globally. So hopefully you'll have the global program as well in the future. That's awesome. Thank you so much, Kyle. Thank you so much, Phil, for joining. Thanks, everyone, for joining us live. And if you're watching on replay, you can always add your comments and questions below, and we will definitely reply and get back to you. Have a great day, everyone. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.